We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer, and Kyle Mabry is at the controls. And we are pleased to have here in studio for this hour of the show, syndicated columnist Leonard Pitts. He's been writing professionally for a long time, ever since he was a college student, since 1991. He's worked for the Miami Herald. He started there as a pop music critic, and then since 1994 has been writing a syndicated column that continues to focus on things like pop culture, but also politics and social issues and family issues. It's in newspapers across the country twice a week. And in our paper here, the News Gazette, it's in today. Maybe there are people who are listening who have read today's column and had read some of the others. He's authored a number of books, six books. He's authored a novel, Before I Forget. There is a collection of columns you might look at. The title of that is Forward From This Moment, that takes its title from a piece that he wrote right after the September 11th attacks, something that I think probably got more comment than anything else, that almost anything else that he had done. Also, he's written about family issues in his book, Becoming Dad, Black Men and the Journey to Fatherhood. He's here. He's visiting the campus sponsored by the College of Media, and will be giving a talk this afternoon at 3 in Gregory Hall, our old stomping grounds, in room 100, talking about junk food, digesting the junk that gets in our heads. That's the title, and it's free and open to anybody who would like to attend. So if you're in and around the campus, you'd like to stop by and hear more from Leonard Pitts, you can do that. And here on the show, we're open to questions. If you want to talk about the role of the commentator, or maybe you have something specific to say about something that he's written about, you can do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And email will-talk at illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So what got you interested in journalism?
Well, I tell people that, journalism, I didn't get into journalism. Journalism got into me. When I was five, I kind of knew what I was put here to do. I knew that I was put here to be a writer. I started identifying myself as that from that age. I started sending stuff out to newspapers and magazines when I was 12, got published when I was 14, got published and paid when I was 18, and sort of never looked back.
Wow. Five?
Yes. I know. Very, rather young to decide your mission in life, but I don't know. There's just something about the whole idea of words and telling stories that really appealed to me.
Well, was that something that was really important in your family, telling stories, maybe?
Not really. Mm-hmm. I've got an uncle that I did not know, particularly at that age, who was a poet in the 40s, but there was nobody, other than that, there was nobody in my family who really did any writing. It was just, I don't know where it came from. It was just something that was in me.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that strikes me when I read your columns is the feeling that, and you know, all columnists have a distinctive voice. They better. That's sort of the point. But I have the sense when I read you that it's like you're talking to me. And I don't think that I really get that feeling with a lot of other columns. I mean, they're good columnists, and I enjoy reading them, and you can learn a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're a little bit maybe too much like a graduate seminar in American political science. But I think what you're doing is it's really different. It seems more, there's more of a feeling of a one-to-one kind of communication.
Well, that's what you're going for, and that's what I think a column should be. I think it should be a, as you say, a one-to-one communication. It mm-hmm. should be, it should not be this sort of thing where you're sort of stuffy and on the mountaintop and pontificating to the eager masses and, you know, deigning to share your wisdom with them. It should be a thing where you're, you know, reasoning things out with people and where you you don't seem like sort of this unapproachable sage. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I've definitely cultivated in my writing. I like there's different voices that you can use in writing, but I like whatever voice I'm using to have some sense of accessibility so that people feel mm-hmm. as if they can talk back.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I want, we have some callers here, and I don't want to make them too long, but I guess one of the things that I want to talk about is, have you talk about a little bit, is the process and mm-hmm. what it is that you go through in doing a piece. And maybe the the place to start is, well, is to ask, well, what's the place that you start?
Well, it starts with that act of desperation and looking for what your next column is. Occasionally, I know one or two columns out what the next column is going to be, but more often it's the day before and nothing has really presented itself. So you're scouring the wires and online and newspapers and whatever, looking for what's going on in the world. And you try to find something that, you know, puts a little hook in your head, something that, you know, won't leave you alone emotionally or intellectually, or something that speaks to some greater issue or problem or moral conundrum. And then you spend the rest of that day basically ordering it in your head. You know, I spend the rest of that day trying to get the lead together. What, you know, what am I going to say? And what are the points that I want to make about this? What are the things that people are likely to say in response? And how can I sort of head them off at the pass? Mm-hmm. You know, things that people are going to say in contradiction of whatever my argument is. How can I sort of head them off at the pass? I just left a classroom full of students, and one of the things that I told them is that writing is not what happens when you sit down at the keyboard. Writing takes place before you sit down at the keyboard. Then when you're at the keyboard, that's basically transcribing. But the bulk of the writing has to happen before that.
I'm sure there are people who think have this idea that writing a column would be easy. Well, all you do is sit down and write a column, but the pressure...
It's supposed to seem easy.
The pressure of having to come up with those columns and doing that for as long as you have been doing it. I don't think people understand what that's like.
There's an expression among columnists that, you know, because we've all had that letter from people who say, I could write a column better than you. And, you know, there's an expression among columnists that, yes, you probably could once. But, you know, after you get that first or second column, after you say that thing that's burning in your gut to say, you know, then you're looking on, you know, another 94 columns for that year alone. And, you know, where does that inspiration come from? And what are the things that you're going to, you know, what things are you going to write about? It can be very difficult. I remember I panicked a lot more in the early days of writing the column than I do now. Mm-hmm. I've come to understand that if you just, you know, relax, keep looking, something is always going to present itself. But there was that ever-present fear that you're going to sit down at the computer with absolutely nothing to say and 20 inches of newspaper space in which to say it, which is kind of daunting, but I've learned to live with it. This is what I do for a living.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned at the beginning that for a number of years, I think 18 years, you wrote about pop music.
Yes, sir.
For the paper. Mm-hmm. Whose idea was it? Was it their idea? Was it your idea to move into being a columnist?
It was mine. And actually, I didn't write solely for the paper. I did the last 3 years of that as a music critic for the paper. I was writing about music in other venues before then. But it was my idea because 18 years is a long time to write about, you know, pop music. That's basically the distance from Barry Manilow to Snoop Dogg. Yeah, I know. Literally.
Just two guys together. Right?
That's from about the beginning, near the beginning of Barry Manilow's career to about the beginning of Snoop Dogg's. And that was just, it was enough. You know, I'd spent enough years doing that and I wanted to do something else.
We have a couple of callers, and we'll bring them into the conversation. Our guest in this hour is syndicated columnist Leonard Pitts. He writes for the Miami Herald, and literally millions of people across the country read his columns twice every week in their papers. It's in our paper, the News Gazette. He's won a lot of recognition for his work, including Pulitzer Prize for Commentary 2004. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455, and we have some callers here, and let us start with someone in Muhammad. They're the first, line number one. Hello.
I read your column on the blessings of marriage, and you didn't mention once in that two columns about black women, which 72% are unmarried. I think you should have mentioned that because I thought it was a great column. It was about Kate Wool, of course. You could have added it as a PS or whatever, an addendum. But, you know, that's very important. It's very important that 72% of black women are unmarried.
I'm not sure if your statistic is right. I think it's a little bit less than that. But regardless, I've written that column on a number of occasions before. And just didn't feel the tug to do it.
I've never read it, and I read your column all the time.
I promise you I've written it, but I just didn't feel the tug to do it in this particular column. I didn't want to make this particular column necessarily about race, but about the broader question of what's happening to the institution of marriage.
Yeah, well, I think marriage is very important.
As do I.
And you you know, you connected it to Will and Kate, which mm-hmm. is just fine. But I'd like to see more columns just on the importance of marriage. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank
All
you.
Right. Any other follow-up you want to?
No.
No? Okay. Good. And over to Belgium, not the country, the community here. Line four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I'd like to talk a little bit more broadly about the media with you, sir. And that is, and it's very topical today, okay, with Mr. Obama's problems with Mr. Trump going on and on about his birthrights here in America, you wonder, isn't the media really making this the play more than what it really is? Because Mr. Trump is just using this as a stage to be more and more on the screen in front of people's eyes when he's bringing up a topic that just seems, to me, for all other reasons, is pretty much racist. They don't want to see a black man with a strange name in a powerful office, and they're trying to find any stupid reason to keep him from serving and serving the nation.
Well, I would tend to agree with you. I think the thing that you have to understand about the media is that we love a sideshow, and we love a circus. It's like the crowds of people on the freeway who will slow down to look at a traffic accident. They know they shouldn't. And, you know, they all curse the person ahead of them who did it, and then they slow down and do the same thing. I think that's something of the mindset of the news media, somewhat to our shame, particularly in cases like this, because you're right, Donald Trump has gotten so much more attention than he deserves for this ludicrous, reinventing or reinvigorating this ludicrous claim. But that's, you know, that's the nature of the show. It might have been different, you know, 20, 30 years ago when there were only three major news networks and it wasn't a 24/7 operation, but you're talking about, you know, those three news networks plus cable plus the internet, and they're all 24/7, and they all need, they all have all the space that they need to fill. And, you know, when a Donald Trump comes along making these silly claims, he's like found gold to them. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. I would have bet money this would have come up, and certainly it's something that you have written about.
Yeah. I wrote about the Donald Trump column is probably one of the angrier columns that I've written in a long time because, as the gentleman said, I think it's downright it doesn't speak to anything about politics. It speaks to the discomfort that a lot of people still have with the idea that their president is this black guy.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is, 40 years ago, they'd have been able to say that, you know, if by some happenstance, some miracle that had happened 40 years ago, they'd have been able to say that and be accepted into polite company, at least in some circles. In 2011, you cannot say I'm uncomfortable with the president being a black guy and still be accepted in any polite circles, you know, by and large. So we have this coded language and we have a history of coded language. When we talk about states' rights, we're talking about, you know, there's a coded language there that's also dealing with race. So this whole thing about Obama, you know, I told somebody this morning, I don't care if you beat him up right, left and sideways over his politics, over things he's done, over things he hasn't done. You know, that's all fair. But the subtext of all of these controversies over where was he born and what's his religion is basically saying you're not us. You're not one of us. You're an outsider. You're a usurper. You don't belong here. And that is categorically, you know, that is undeniably about his race.
Yeah. It's just it continues to astound me that people just can't let go of this.
Yeah.
Last night I was reading and we read on the web just something that I came across with someone who in response to, I think actually it was in response to the piece that you wrote just mm-hmm. recently of this long screed. I mean, it must have been 10 times as long as the column that you wrote from somebody who clearly was very angry with mm-hmm. you and with the president and this very long thing about how it is that you were wrong, and how it is that that still the president has not been forthcoming, and why won't he just show us the birth certificate, and why, you know, why is there this attempt to hide the truth? I don't know why people just won't let, why they just can't let this go.
Because I don't think they can admit to themselves where they're coming from. I think a lot of them, you know, the motives that we just talked about in terms of race, I think that's hidden from a lot of the people who are actually making these claims. I think a lot of them feel that they're coming from a logical place. I think that they have sort of hidden from themselves what the motives are, and I think that's part of the reason why they can't let it go, because to let it go is to have to deal with what was the real source of your discomfort with this guy. It's not his politics. You know, it's the color of his skin, and it is, you know, it's his strange or his exotic name, or however you want to put it.
Well, do you think now that the White House has again made an attempt to address this and has apparently made public a birth certificate, that's not going to end this, is it?
No, and I wish they hadn't done it, to tell you the truth, because it's sort of caving, and I understand his need to probably want to put it behind and let's move forward. But I think that in doing that and going through the extra step of getting the original birth certificate and putting it before the masses, it's not going to put this to sleep. Mm-hmm. Because if this was ever about logic, it would have been put to sleep a long time ago. You know, the mistake that they're making, the mistake we often make these days, is trying to answer unreason with reason. It'll never work because unreason by definition can't be answered by reason. The other thing is I wish that he hadn't done it because it's basically caving in. It's basically, you know, validating, you know, or saying these people have a right to suggest that he is some usurper, that he's some other. No other president that I've in my lifetime that I know of, no leader in my lifetime has had so much fuss over a blankety-blank birth certificate to the degree that they have to now go and find the original form. You know, where is this coming from? I wish he had told them all to go and take a short walk on a long beer.
Now, you don't think
long
that
walk on a short beer,
you
said. Yeah, right.
You don't think that this is some kind of a part of a political strategy that someone says, well, actually, if this continues to be an issue, that it will make his opponents look like not very serious people, and maybe it's not such a bad thing if this continues to rattle around here as we're moving towards another campaign.
Yeah, I think strategically, from a political from a point of political strategy, it is wise. It is good for him if this keeps rattling around. But I don't know if I guess there's two ways to look at it. You could say that by not putting out the original birth certificate, he allows them to keep going on with what they're doing. Or you could say that in putting out the original birth certificate and knowing that they're still going to continue with the same line of you know, thought, and I use that word advisedly, even though they now have what they purported to want, it only goes to further prove how divorced from reality they are. So I guess it can be played both ways.
Here's an email that touches on this. We have someone writing in and says, do you agree with fellow columnist David Brooks from the New York Times, that there's a sentiment among some American people that holds a, quote, hunger for the ultimate blowhard who would lead us through hard times, an end quote, and that this sentiment is personified by Donald Trump?
Yes. I have not phrased it in that way, but I've sort of written the same thing in columns of mine, that there's sort of this need in American political life for the person who sort of cuts through and makes things simple. You know, there's this hunger for it. You see it in our movies about presidents, where presidents, you know, the movie Dave is one of my favorites because you got this everyman, this sort of everyday guy who just sort of solves the problems with some old everyday common sense of just the average guy. And the problem with that is that it is a fantasy. There's a reason it's a movie and not a reality. The world is, and the nation, for that matter, very complicated, you know, place. And when Donald Trump says he could lower oil prices by sitting down with OPEC and looking them in the eyes and saying, fellas, look, it's got to stop. You know, it appeals to a very simplistic part of us, I suppose. But you have to know, if you have a single brain cell working, that's not going to fly. You know, I understand the simplistic appeal, but, you know, it's not going to fly.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Leonard Pitts. He writes a syndicated column, works for the Miami Herald. His column appears in papers twice a week across the country. He's visiting the campus. We'll give a talk this afternoon, and we'll talk with you. You have questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Back to some callers here. Champagne is next, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mr. Pitts. I'd like to start off by saying I really enjoy your column. I myself am a recent graduate in journalism. I work at the News Gazette. I was just wondering if you had any suggestions or tips for someone like me who is interested in a lot of the same things you are in today's media market. Thank you.
All right.
I was going to ask him to sort of expand on suggestions or tips to do what. Assuming we're talking about career advancement, the thing that I always say is, and that I don't think enough attention is given to, is that, you know, this is not a, as the cliche goes, this is not a sprint, it's a marathon. So I think that you really have to hone your skills and polish your skills and make a long haul commitment to being unaccepting of anything less than the very best that you know that you have to do. And I always hesitate in giving that answer because I suspect that people are looking for some simple bullet point that they can do. You know, do point A, point B, and point C, and you'll, you know, have a wonderful career and live happily ever after. And I can't give them that. The only thing that I can give them, and the only thing that has ever worked for me, is to have a near obsessional devotion to being the best that you can be, to getting the most you can out of your talent. You know, trust your talent, trust whatever, you know, trust your ability, hone it to the best that you can possibly make it, and go for broke. I mean, it really boils down to that. Nothing. If there's a great simple bullet point secret, you know, I don't know it. That's the only thing that's ever been able to work for me.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people, certainly in the newspaper business and in broadcast as well, are thinking about the future and wondering maybe not so much is there a future, but what is the future?
Yeah, I think we're right to wonder and frankly to fear. I'm hoping that, as some people have said, the iPad and other tablet computers will be the salvation of our industry. But I think that the newspaper itself is in difficulty, and I think that if newspapers go, then we are in a lot of trouble, because the newspaper is essentially the only news organization that performs the function that it does, a function of watchdog of your local or regional government. CNN deals with national issues, and whatever it does on a local level is something that probably originated in a newspaper. The local TV station is about who got shot last night, what the weather's going to be tomorrow, and how did the local sports team do. The only entity that is, and you know, the bloggers are about responding to whatever has been reported elsewhere. The only entity that is about, you know, is the mayor accepting kickbacks and what's the governor's budget going to do for the schools and et cetera, et cetera. The only entity that is doing that is the local newspaper. So we all have a vested interest in seeing that newspapers continue to be viable. And, you know, they are in sad shape right now.
Other callers. Next, we will talk with someone in Urbana, and this is line two. Hello.
Hello. Mr. Pitts, I would like to suggest a subject to write about, and because it's important and it bears repeating. Originally, in the last month or so, George Will wrote a column about the Defense Department, and the gist of his article is that the Defense Department is not even audible. It has no paper trail, so they are in effect asking us to pay to give them money, and they spend $1.5 billion, maybe $2 billion a day. And as I say, there's no audit to it. I'll give you a couple quotes here. Randy Forbes, a Virginia Republican, said that for 4 years the department has not complied with the law requiring audible financial statements, and he charged that none of the budget is even in a position to be audited. Senator Tom Coburn, Republican, Oklahoma, says the Pentagon is one of the few agencies in the federal government that cannot produce auditable financial statements in accordance with the law.
Well, you know, I don't profess to be an expert on budgetary matters, but I will say that I'm heartened to see to know that George Will wrote that. I must have missed that particular column, but I'm heartened to hear that he wrote that. I forget the exact statistic, but we spend more on defense than I think the next 40 countries or something like that combined, some unimaginable number. And I think that as we look at this era of austerity that we seem to be embarked upon, you know, it's all well and good to ask the schools and the teachers and, you know, all these other entities to take a cut and to do more with less. I think that I'm glad to see that that defense is not off the table. I'm really glad to see that. And I say that as someone who, you know, believes in a strong defense, but I'm wondering if we have spent past the point that we need to for the defense of this nation and for the fulfillment of our military obligations.
Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, the caller is line three. This is also Urbana. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I have 2 points. One, the statement that the person being interviewed just made was that America is uncomfortable with our president being a black man. That's simply absolutely ludicrous. That's playing the race card and the most dishonest way that could be made. I couldn't believe the comment. I could not believe the comment that I heard from him.
Can you explain to me then, please, why the Republican leader of the GOP, and I believe it was Southern California, just the other day apologized for putting out a picture of the president as a chimp? Why?
That has nothing to do, factually, with your argument about the birth certificate. This is a simple matter of legal compliance everyone else has to comply with.
Madam, the president has produced his birth certificate. He did it before he was president, as a matter of fact.
He didn't produce the one with the serial numbers, the official one.
Yeah, actually, he did. The serial number was blacked out, and that is the official one. If you get a birth certificate in the state of Hawaii, and I can attest to this also in the state of California, you get a computer abstract. And that is what he produced, and that is what people who claim that he has failed to produce his birth certificate continuously fail to ignore. And I'm sorry, I see no logical reason for this debate or this discussion to be going on.
I know, and I can't believe why you raised it. That was crazy. Nobody, everybody, that is not a factor whatsoever, his race. It is not.
Ma'am, we've lived different experiences, and I look
Perhaps
at...
Perhaps we have.
And I look...
I don't understand why you're playing the race card.
May I finish my point? And I look at the things that are being said about this president. I look at congressmen, I forget their names, but two congressmen referring to him as uppity. I look at the mayor in Southern California.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
Can I finish?
Politics gets criticized. So madam, can bring in the race
madam, may I finish my sentence? I look at the mayor in Southern California putting out the email with the White House with a watermelon patch in front. I look at the two lawmakers who called him boy. I look at the study showing that the Tea Party has a generally higher level of racial rancor than most of the rest of the country. And I look at my own experience as an African-American man, and I'm sorry. I stand by what I said.
Have you gotten more angry response, people who are unhappy about things that you've written that has to do with things like this, generally speaking, race in America, and maybe more specifically about how people think about the president? Has that drawn more comment than other sorts of things?
It draws more comment, and it draws more rationalization of the sort that, you know, is going on here, where you know, when you lay out, okay, this is what leads me to this, people do not tend to engage on those facts. People do not tend to engage on, okay, why are the statistics this and why did this person say that if there is no racial discomfort? They tend to just make blanket statements and then leave them unsupported. That's something that's sort of very common and also kind of disheartening.
We're just about the point here. I'm going to have to take a little break. I don't want to cut off the caller completely. If you just wanted to do a little follow-up, I can give you a chance to do that.
Yeah, my question is, the George Soros-funded Media Matters is a 501c3, and it's required by law to be non-political. And as anybody who's ever listened a minute to it, it's so extremely political. How do you, in your journalism, explain that?
I don't feel compelled to explain that. I've never written a word in defense or condemnation of Media Matters, and I don't know why that question would even land on my doorstep.
We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with syndicated columnist Leonard Pitts, and we will talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
As we wind up our look at 150 years of City of Champaign history, Illinois Pioneers takes a look at the industries that have helped transform and grow our community. From forges to food, transportation to technology, and agriculture to aviation, the industrial history of Champaign is a fascinating snapshot of the country in general. Next time on Illinois Pioneers.
7:30 Thursday night on WILL-TV. Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
This is Focus. We're here weekday mornings with 10 topics for you every week. Tomorrow morning in the 11 o'clock hour, this hour of the show, our guest will be David Weinberger. He's a senior researcher at the Berkman Center at Harvard University. He's also co-director of the Harvard Law School Library Lab. We'll talk about knowledge in the age of social media. And then if you're thinking about buying a new car, you'll want to be listening Friday in the 11 o'clock hour. Our guest will be Mike Quincy. He's the auto content specialist with Consumer Reports. They have just put out their new car issue. It's something that they do every year in April, where they rate the best and the worst of new cars. So car-oriented questions are welcome. That's Friday at 11. The complete schedule is on our website. You can also listen to past shows you might have missed, WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour, my guest is Leonard Pitts. He works for the Miami Herald, has been there since 1991. He started out writing pop music reviews and articles for the paper, and then since 1994 has been doing a syndicated column. It runs in papers across the country, including ours, the News Gazette. He's the author of 6 books, among them a novel, Before I Forget, and a book about being a dad entitled Becoming Dad, Black Men and the Journey to Fatherhood. He's on the campus, his visit sponsored by the College of Media. He'll be talking on the topic, junk food, digesting the junk that gets in our heads, this afternoon at 3. And room 100, Greg Hall, and anybody you'd like to stop by is welcome. And questions are welcome, too, here. We got several others. We'll get back to the phones with somebody in, in Champaign, I believe, in line number 1. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah.
I've always been fascinated with the art of editing. With that in mind, especially it comes into play with longer pieces, you know, such as books and that. I mean, some people are just really extremely good at it. How many, in terms of rewriting your column, do you spend much time with that, or, you know?
You sound like one of my kind of folks, what I call a word nerd. well, welcome, brother. I spend a lot of time. I just told a class full of students about an hour or so ago that writing is rewriting, and I think that's something that a lot of younger writers fail to understand. It takes a lot of work to make it look easy, which is the goal. So any given piece of mine that you read in the paper, I probably, you know, read over 20 times, if not more, in just terms of the polishing. The first passes are, you know, changing really big stuff, you know, maybe moving paragraphs around or taking things out or whatever. The second passes are about polishing things, tightening up the language, looking for more inventive ways of saying a thing. The third passes are, you know, sort of fine grain, maybe moving a semicolon or moving a comma or something along those lines. I read it until I tell them I read it till it bores me, which means there's nothing else I can think of to change. Then I read it again. Then I send it to the editor, and then after she's done, I read it again.
What happens after it's published? Sometimes.
Then it's sort of like if it's bad, you're stuck with it, which is why one reason I'm so obsessive beforehand. It's sort of like your high school yearbook picture. You know, if it's bad, it's going to follow you down through perpetuity with the butterfly collar and the weird smile on your face or whatever. So, I tend to be very obsessive beforehand, just to make sure that when it's in the paper, I can actually read it without, you know, getting stomach distress.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Thank you. So once you've got the piece mm-hmm. to the point where you feel you've done what you can,
yeah.
then it does go to the paper, and an editor there makes suggestions.
Right.
You know how much comes back then from the editor.
It usually comes back pretty clean. They tell me that I turn a pretty clean copy, unless I've missed a misspelled a word or something along those lines. They usually don't make a lot of changes, which frankly makes me a little bit nervous, you know. But you know, that's what they do. They don't make a whole lot of changes. But then after it comes back from them, I'll read it again, just to make sure, and you know, just to triple check the facts and, mm-hmm. and just make sure everything is as it should be.
So have there been times when it's come back and the editor said, "Are you really sure you want to say this?" Something like that?
Not really. Occasionally there'll be something where, you know, you've written something and it could be interpreted a different way. Maybe they know what you're saying, but it could also be interpreted in a different way. And they'll point that out and you know, you'll go and make changes in that regard. But other than that, no. They don't really edit for your opinion. They edit for, you know, your clarity in stating your opinion.
Yeah. Well, I suppose if they didn't want your opinion,
yeah.
they wouldn't have hired you to do that one.
Yeah, exactly.
To, line number, where am I going next? Line number 2, thank you very much. Line number 2, I think that's Urbana. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to comment on the caller who
accused you of playing the race card on the birther issue. And it's interesting because I think this also points to the media failure to fully examine this so that people can understand some of the underlying messages, and particularly the coded language that you referred to, what Politico.com referred to as dog whistle politics, and the notion that there's a pitch that some people will get automatically. And I think some of these issues have created a convenient place for people to park some of their racial attitudes. But specifically on the reference to the chimp photo that was sent out by Marilyn Davenport, the Republican leader in Orange County, it goes back to some of the 19th century construction of African American identity that clearly was designed to degrade, to dehumanize. And when we see these pictures, which often arise now in connection with Obama, it certainly is a message that this is somebody who is not one of us. Not only that, but not human. But we don't even have to get to that interpretation if you just look at what Marilyn Davenport wrote when she sent the picture out, that this is proof. No wonder there's no birth certificate. So this clearly ties in a race issue with the birther movement, and she is a Tea Party supporter. So I just wanted to add that because clearly the race card was played by the birthers and now by extension Trump.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's funny that you should mention that there was a book. You were talking about the 19th and 20th century construction of African-American identity. There was a book that I happened across in the Library of Congress, and it's I think it's available online, the actual book itself, called The Negro a Beast by Charles Carroll, I believe, was the author. And it the illustrations of the book sort of make the same point that you're making. There's a series of illustrations of black and white together, and you've got the white guy who's sort of upright and of great, you know, great bearing, and you've got the black guy who looks like a cross between, you know, King Kong and I don't know, and some other simian, some other ape, and it's making its point very clearly. And I think it is the luxury that people like, what was her name, Marilyn, you said?
Marilyn Davenport. Republican leader, yeah.
It is a luxury that somebody like her has to not know, or to profess to not know, this history that somebody like me as an African-American can never have. The thing is, you talk about code words. I've been black for 53 years now, and I have seldom been, you know, I've seldom had someone come up to me and say, hello, I am a racist, you know, and I will now be discriminating against you.
Right.
Okay. What happens is that at least in my, you know, experience, is that you experience something that, and you experience a series of somethings that you look for other explanations for, and no other explanation, so, you know, seems to suffice or seems to fit it, and then you come to understand reluctantly that perhaps this is about race. That's how race works in this country. I think a lot of folks would like it if, you know, people would wear the T-shirt that said, I'm a racist and I'm not discriminating. That's not the way. That is not how it works.
I think you're absolutely right. It's subtle in many ways, but it doesn't take much to scratch the surface. And, you know, particularly in a period of high anxiety about the economy, about wars, people, you know, want to point to some other reason for the troubles that they're facing. And right now it's the other. There's no question about it.
Well, there's a history of that. There's a history of scapegoating.
Yeah.
And as I said, we tend to want to be able to point the racist out in the crowd because he's got the horns and the tail and the pitchfork. And then you look at somebody like, you know, not to pick on the poor guy, but you look at somebody like Mel Gibson, who made movies with Danny Glover, these famous buddy movies of this black and white pair. And then, you know, months later, years later, here's this awful, awful stuff that he's saying. And nobody would have looked at him and said, oh, my God, there's the second coming of Bull Connor. There's David Duke. But he stands condemned by words that he screamed in anger.
Well, he had to have been thinking about it, and people do have
exactly
a tendency to compartmentalize racism and sexism and heterosexualism. There's one person they might accept as an exception to everyone else in the group, but they still have those negative feelings about the group.
Yeah, well, you don't want to admit to those feelings, because what does that say to you about you? Mm-hmm. So there's always this need to make it about something else. But again, if you're not hair trigger, and I hope I'm not hair trigger, and if you've been black for a few years, and I have, then you kind of know the stuff for what it is when you see it.
Well, thanks for your thoughtful work.
Right, well, thank you. Just a couple of emails here I'd like to get in. Compliments. Someone writes, just want to thank you for your insightful weekly articles that are published in our local paper. Your articles cut through the truth of many issues. Thanks for thinking about and writing about social issues so deeply and honestly.
Thank you.
That is one. And here's someone who also says that they really enjoyed your book, Becoming Dad.
Thank you.
The person who writes, I'm a human service caseworker working with families receiving medical and food stamp benefits. I do have some single fathers, but mainly single mothers, so I found your book particularly interesting. Thanks for the book. And do you have plans for other books?
Well, the first novel came out in 2009, and the next novel comes out in 2011. There's not presently another nonfiction book on the horizon, but that may change.
So what interests you in writing fiction?
Fiction was always actually my first interest. I sort of fell into being a music critic while waiting for a $1 million advance check on the first novel, which
hasn't come yet.
I'm still waiting for it. You know, I think it got mixed up in the mail and went to Stephen King or something. But you know, fiction was always the first love. I love the idea of, you know, creating a world and then getting to play in it, creating people and then getting to put them in motion and play with them. It's fun.
Hmm. We're talking this morning in this hour with Leonard Pitts. He's a syndicated columnist. His columns appear twice a week in papers across the country, including ours, the News Gazette. He's visiting the campus, and we'll talk to you if you give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and also email is possible, wilt-talk@illinois.edu. And we have a bunch of people here on the phone, and we'll go next to Piatt County, Line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I just briefly but sincerely wanted to thank you for, I teach composition, and it's just been, I've had so many good discussions using your articles, but I will tell you that I handed out one of the articles and one of my students said, oh, that's Leonard Pitts ranting again. And I thought that was great because it showed that he was reading the articles. You know, they are published in our local newspaper. So students want to ramble on and on in incredible generalities about things they know so little about, and so I'm very happy to use your articles and talk about the things you've mentioned. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I'll just say it's not just students who have that tendency.
Well, you when you approach a topic, again, it may be that people think what columnists are doing is they're just writing it right out of their heads, and they're saying, okay, this is what I think about this thing. You, what sort of research do you do when you're working on a topic?
It depends on the topic. I mean, there are topics that, you know, that require no research. There are topics that require a lot of research. But, you know, whatever the topic is, it's not something that I have just thought about for the first time that day, you know, particularly with regard to race, but also with regard to other things. These are things that I've spent a lot of time thinking about and writing about and sort of trying to get a handle on. So, it, you know, there's little, if any, shoot from the hip in writing a column, for the same reason that there's a lot of polishing in writing a column, because once it's written and it's out there, it's there forever. And if you shot from the hip and you were wrong, then you're wrong forever. And that's not something that I find, you know, that I'm comfortable with. So, you know, anything I write about grows out of a whole lot of reflection.
All right. To back here, some local folks. They're all Champaign. First, line one. Hello.
Been reading your column regularly, really enjoy it.
Thank you.
In fact, I've been reading political columns for about 50 years now, and you mentioned George Will.
Mm-hmm.
That made me wonder. Surely you must read the other columnists. I'm asking for an opinion now. Columnists say at the conservative stripe and the more liberal stripe, maybe one from each, who do you think is best out there writing columns today?
I think my favorite columnist, and I don't know if I can do you one from column A, one from column B, but I love George. I love George Will because he makes me think, and he requires me to earn my right to disagree with him.
Yes.
I like Kathleen Parker because she's an elegant writer, and she's I like her intellectual honesty, even when I disagree with her. I like Connie Schultz of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Al Martinez of the LA Daily News. The late David Broder, I was a big fan, and
yeah.
When he was writing his column, I was a huge fan of Dave Barry, who's a humorist and my colleague at the Miami Herald.
Yes. Okay, well, that answers the question. Thank
All right.
you very much.
Very good.
Thank you.
On to line three. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Pitts. I used
Hi.
To read your column, and I relished the opportunity, but at some point in time, I couldn't deal with the
some of the editorials and the letters to the editor of the News Gazette, so I had to make a cost-benefit analysis, but you were surely on the benefit side.
Well, thank you.
But anyway, in reference to the lady who accused you of using a race card, I think I've been a black American male for 62, almost 63 years, so mm-hmm. I understand. Whenever I've been in a situation, I've really tried to guard against making that judgment rashly, and I look
exactly.
at a lot of factors.
Exactly.
And even I've gone to some of my white colleagues and said what I thought was racism. They said they don't care if you're black, white, polka dot. And I was reading a book, Between Barack and a Hard Place, Racism and White Denial mm-hmm. in the Age of Obama by Tim Wise. And Tim raised an interesting question.
I love Tim Wise.
Racism will never leave us if we have this this defensive mechanism of some form of white denial, like you're just playing the race card, or nobody would discriminate against you whether you're white, black, or polka dot. And he says that statement was a racist statement because somebody white thinks they know more about my reality as a black man in this country. So I just want you to stick with it. But unless we people can come to realize, in light of the sordid racial history of this country, and get away from the white denial, only then, in my estimation, will we really address the issue of what's racist and what's not.
Well, there's two things I'd like to say in response. One, I think that, as you know, a fair accounting would say that as African Americans, we probably made the white denial a lot more possible by some of us claiming racism where racism, you know, did not exist. One of my favorite recent examples is the people who tried to make Kwame Brown, the former mayor of Detroit, a racial martyr when he was just a crook. You know, he was a crook who couldn't keep his zipper up. You know,
right.
that was Kwame Brown's sin. And a lot of us tried to make him a racial, you know, martyr. So I understand that. The problem is that I don't think we understand is that you only have so much moral capital. When you expend it on a Kwame Brown, it makes it easier for people who are already inclined to deny to feel justified in doing so. Nobody wants to feel as if, you know, the difficulty in discussing race, if you're white and if you perceive yourself to be a white person of good intentions and, you know, and a decent person, is that you're going to feel personally indicted, as if I'm trying to put something on you by saying this, you know, this was, you know, racially motivated. And for people, again, speaking of people of goodwill, you've got to give them a way to come around that, to see that, okay, this problem exists, but I don't have to be part of the problem. You know, there's space for me to be part of the solution. And that's something that I don't think we have yet evolved a way to do in this country. If you follow what I'm saying, you
know, I understand.
I mean, there's white people who are going to be racist and going to be comfortable in their racism, and there's not a whole lot you can do about that. But there are people who are maybe innocently racist or just innocently non-informed, and if you treat them like David Duke or like, you know, Bull Connor or something, then you're never going to be able to reach those folks. But if you give them a way to say, if you make it non-threatening, you know, honest but non-threatening enough that they can, that you can bring them around, then you've got allies as opposed to opponents, and I think you make it less possible, less likely that people are going to deny and rationalize. But you're right, the rationalization and the denial get incredibly thick sometimes. And I look at you know, I even the lady that we were talking about earlier, what a luxury it must be to be able to dismiss or to write off any evidence that does not comport with your pre-chosen theory, which is that I'm playing the race card. That's a great luxury that she has, and I don't even think she realizes it.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Try to get at least one more caller in here in the time that we have left. That'll be line number 2 and Champagne. Hello.
Yes. I wonder if what you think about this. I think that one of the big problems with the white denialism, if you will, that the previous caller noticed, is the range of things that all get labeled racism, ranging from the Bull Connor kind of racism that existed in the you know, 40s and 50s, to the, you know, today you have more the subtle racism, in some cases even the unconscious racism, even things, you know, if somebody maybe is trying to pick a job applicant, they may not even realize that when they're judging two resumes that are otherwise equal, that, you know, they may favor one over the other based on subtle clues in the resume, even though, you know, after work they might have, and in their neighborhood they might have black friends that they have no problem socializing with. But, you know, it's a totally different kind of thing. I think in some cases the people who deny being racist, it's because to them racism is a holding black people as second-class citizens and refusing them opportunities legally. You know, it's a totally different thing. I almost wonder if we need different words for, you know, so that you can have conversations about these things, because as long as people can point to this to this higher level of racism, they can say that's not me, and it really isn't. They honestly aren't that.
Yeah,
and that's what they see. Whereas, you know, this forming of stereotypes, I mean, I've seen anybody who has, I mean, everybody has stereotypes about other groups, you know, bankers, lawyers, people of, you know, another gender, another race. People form stereotypes. That's how we work. And anybody, I've seen people with any kind of a stereotype labeled sexist and racist. And I really think that gets in the way of the conversation.
I think you make an excellent point, and I agree with you in pretty much all respects. Racism is not always, you know, the bull counter burning the cross type of thing. And people need to understand that. And if it takes different language or more, you know, language that allows for gradations, then I'm all for that.
Yeah, just one last quick thought without enough room really to talk about it. I just think about how when Barack Obama was elected, there were some people who were incautiously saying, oh, post-racial era, that in a way that it's actually brought, no, that means racism is anything worse, but in some odd way, it's actually brought it out in the open more.
Well, I spoke with the historian Lerone Bennett Jr. about that, and he reminded me that the same things that were said after Obama was elected were said after slavery, were said after Brown v. Board of Education, were said after the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, et cetera. So we keep looking for a bolt of lightning that's going to make us enlightened, and it hasn't happened yet.
Our guest, Leonard Pitts, a syndicated columnist for the Miami Herald. You can read his column in our paper, the News Gazette, and a lot of others, or you can go to LeonardPitts.com, and you can read some of the past columns, or you can look for the collection Forward from This Moment, some of his past work. Also, you might want to look at his novel Before I Forget, or the book Becoming Dad, Black Men and the Journey to Fatherhood. He's on the campus, his visit sponsored by the folks at the College of Media, and he'll be talking this afternoon on the campus, 3 o'clock in room 100, Greg Hall, on junk food, digesting the junk that gets in our heads. That's what the talk is called, and anybody who'd like to attend should feel welcome. Thanks very much.
And my pleasure. Thank you.